On Thursday, October 13, Guelph's MP Lloyd Lunfield got us up to speed on what's happening in Ottawa. In this episode, we learn about housing initiatives, Ontario-specific issues related to healthcare and daycare, supports to help those most affected by inflation, refugees from Ukraine and Afghanistan, and Canada's policies regarding climate change. After this federal update, we learn a little bit about three candidates running for election in Guelph's Ward 4.
Yeah. Okay, we're up and running. It's great to see everybody. And too bad that we aren't in person. I was looking forward to that this morning, but obviously we're still in a pandemic, and so we're still in Zoom. And really that's, as I was thinking about what to talk about this morning, and I saw your questions of topics, and those are the topics of the day for sure. Being still in the pandemic, but really a different phase of it. We can see the numbers are going up again. People are not wearing masks, gathering again, where it's going to be colder temperatures. And so there's some real risks going into the winter months that we're really trying to ask people to make sure they get their vaccines. I just had my fifth, so I'm getting a collection. It's like my grandson's Pokemon cards. I've got all these different vaccines in my wallet that I think we all need to be doing those things, washing our hands and wearing masks. And when I'm on an airplane, even though you don't have to anymore, I'm still wearing a mask because we're still not out of it. So housing was one of the parts that we saw the climbing housing prices, and they were really out of control as we were trying to get out of the lockdown periods that we had and back into the economy. People started shifting. Toronto started moving out because people were doing more things virtually. The demand on housing was high. The supply was low. And so this morning's talk is a little bit about economics, because economics is real. And when you're not supplying the market, prices go up. And that's the story of this pandemic recovery so far, has been around supply and the constraints on supply, where there's labor shortages everywhere, more than a million jobs unfilled in Canada now, and it's climbing. As people are retiring, maybe getting burned out or just not wanting to go back into the market, we have a real shortage of people. That will start showing up in rising wages, hopefully. And but the downside of rising wages is it'll probably drive some unemployment numbers. So there's some things that are going to be happening that we're really watching carefully in terms of the balance between wage increases, unemployment, and what we need to do to continue to support people through those periods. The Bank of Canada has increased interest rates to try and get our inflation down into the 3% range, which is their target. It's independently run. A lot of media around fire the head of the Bank of Canada. He's doing his job to try and get our inflation down. Inflation peaked this summer at 8.1%. It's down to 7%. We're hoping the peak has happened and that we're back down on the way to towards 3% inflation. But then that has the inflation that we have has increased the prices of all kinds of things. And as I said, because supply has not recovered, we don't have labor supply. We also don't have material supply. Global supply chains are all messed up because we're all going through the same thing. And then you add Vladimir Putin to the equation, which isn't helping anybody, especially the people in Ukraine. Ukraine supplies a lot to the world in terms of food. So those prices are going to happen. And also climate change is one that we don't talk enough about. California is not supplying fruits and vegetables to the market the way they have in the past because of droughts and fires and the shifting demand on the shifting supply on food is driving up prices. So what we're doing now to try and get us limping through the startup of the economy is to provide some additional supports to the most vulnerable people. And so things like rental assistance, you know, $500 towards rental assistance to not pay for rent, but to pay for the increased cost of rent that's happening because of the inflationary cycle that we're in. Providing seniors with additional money with, the GST with $500 for seniors, GST credit is doubling. This week, we'll have the first carbon pricing incentive credits hitting bank accounts by hopefully tomorrow. And that's going to help people that have had additional costs on fuel. So the price on pollution that we've put in has added about 7 cents a liter to gasoline, and it's going to continue to go up by the formula that we've given, that $15 a year per ton. So next April, it'll increase again. And that's also to try and shift behavior to say, so fossil fuels are going to be expensive, and we're going to do that gradually but steadily over time. So you have to look at ways to not use fossil fuels, and we'll provide some help to get into EVs, and we have those programs in place, and then to get more charging stations out there. The dental piece was the agreement that we had with the NDP. And so what we were able to do quickly was to introduce the legislation in the House that we'll be voting on this coming week to provide some relief on dental costs for children under 12, so up to $600 a year. It isn't the full dental program, because the full dental program needs to be agreed on by provinces and territories, and each province has a different way of handling dental care and dental insurance, and so that's going to be a job, and it's going to take some time. So we've put in the interim measures of through CRA. We can do, as we learned through COVID, we can do a lot of work through CRA. And as long as people do their tax returns, we can get them money through CRA. And so that's how the carbon price incentive is going to come to people through CRA. You don't have to apply for it. It just happens. It goes into your bank account. We know your bank account because of CRA. Doing income tax returns with people. And so we have a very easy mechanism for us to use, provided people do their returns. And then in Guelph, we have lots of volunteers that help with returns for people that are lower income. So we're trying to help the vulnerable through it without adding to inflation. So as we put these targeted programs, one-time payments going towards people that are lower income, they're not going to be going out and spending the money and stimulating the economy in ways that they wouldn't otherwise. They're going to be buying food. They're going to be paying rent. They're going to be putting gas in their car. So really the programs that we're working on for seniors and lower income people are fixed and lower income people are there to try and help them specifically. Daycare was another issue. So early learning and childcare, we put an agreement in place with the province, which they've now reneged after they've signed an agreement, which just, for me, I just shake my head. I can't believe that they do what they do sometimes. So what they've done is the private daycare providers were supposed to provide us with their financials. So just like anybody that receives money from any organization that receives money from the federal government, you have to give the financials to show that the money is going where we're intending it to go. And so it's a very reasonable request. We're giving you billions, $1.8 billion. Give us your financials to show that the money is going towards childcare. And the for-profit childcare providers said, no, we're not going to do that because we're a private company. You can't see our financials. And so the province said, okay, well, you're right. We won't ask you for your financials. And so we said, but wait a minute, we don't want our money to be going towards dividends for people that own shares in childcare providers. That's not the deal. You can have reasonable profits, and we'll talk about what that is. And we've been working with them on what a reasonable profit is, but we need your financials. And so that's where we're at right now. So the province of Ontario, you haven't seen a lot of announcements because they're stalling on childcare. We've given them a bit of an extension. I think they've got until the end of November to come back with an agreement with us. And again, if we can reduce the cost of childcare, that's going to help with the inflationary fighting that we're doing right now with people that are having trouble paying bills. All of a sudden, there's going to be a windfall if you've got children in childcare. And one of my daughters in Toronto is paying $2,600 a month. If they get to $10 a day, it's going to mean that their $1 million condo, that the basement condo they have, and the interest rates are going up. I mean, that's a real thing that's going to help them live where they're living and continue to live where they're living. And they're part of millions of Canadians that are facing the same things. So airports was another topic, and it is going better. I use the airport every Monday. No option. I'd love to go to YKF, but we don't have a flight to Ottawa. I have been driving through COVID, but I don't like that carbon footprint either. And it's a lot of wear and tear on a vehicle. Then I got to get a new vehicle and I don't want to do that. So I go to Pearson and it's starting to flow. They've put people in place. They've had to do a lot of hiring. They lost 90% of their business in COVID, and they lost a whole bunch of staff, or lost either through laying them off or because people went and had to find work somewhere else. And because there's a labor shortage, you can't just fill those spots again. Same with immigration and with passports. There were no passports for years, and then people that have never had a passport before have decided that they're going to travel. And so we got hit with a double whammy, but now passports are getting processed within a couple of weeks. I got some nice emails from people in Guelph saying, I was surprised. I went there, I had an appointment, I didn't have to wait in line, and I'm getting my passport. One thing that wasn't on the topic that I'll just touch on is refugees. The Ukraine, we're getting people from Ukraine into Guelph. I've met with some of them. It's really tough when the father is still over fighting and mom and kids are here. The kids are in school trying to pick up their English and they're doing better than mom is. Mom has an engineering degree and is trying to get some jobs lined up. But the people in Guelph are supporting, responding. And Afghan, similar story. We had to change our immigration processes in both cases because we aren't set up to lift people out of war zones. We can take them out of refugee camps. We have a process for refugee camps, but we don't have it at war zones. And so we've been able to set up some processes for war zones, which now Iran is the next one. And so last night I was talking with a young lady from Iran whose family is over there. And in the next week or so, we're hoping to have some processes in place to help the people that are in Iran in their so-called government that is now brutalizing their people, especially the women that are trying to exercise their rights. And the Baha'i faith has been locked out of education, and the Baha'i faith is really under fire, literally, by their own government. And so there's no shortage of work in the land of MPs. I'm very concerned about the getting out of the COVID cycle and how we can do that in a way that the most vulnerable are supported. Mental health is one big focus for me right now in the integrated mental health centers. I was at Royal City Mission yesterday and I met with Kevin and Mark. Their volumes have doubled and tripled, and they got some money from the federal government to get some freezers and fridges put in. And these weren't the ones made by Danby. These are room-sized freezers that are delayed because of construction delays because of COVID, but they're getting those finished up. But then the additional challenge of drugs on the street and the opioid crisis is raging, and the mental health and opioids mixture that we're dealing with in downtown Guelph and other parts of Guelph is something that is a huge concern. Yesterday I also met with the Children's Foundation to talk about how the children are being supported through all of this, and then also meeting with Helen Fishburne at CMHA. So there's a lot of work this winter on mental health and addictions that we hope to be doing. Housing in Guelph, we've had 6 projects, $43 million from the federal government through CMHC for housing, 263 units. The Parkview Motel was a great success story. Gail, amazing. She's never done a development before. She's done shelters and she's done all the work around feeding vulnerable people, but she had never had to build something before. And she got a team together in Guelph and put together a terrific project that's going to be completed hopefully before the winter gets too far in. And we've had Wyndham House has done some really good work. Michael House has done an expansion. Stonehenge is doing some great work. So we're trying to get housing into the most vulnerable parts. And so I'll leave off on that. The housing projects, there's enough of them that I'm now creating a map for myself to see, okay, I had 10 on my list and we've got 6 done and there's 4 left. One isn't going to go, we know, and one that we hope to see go forward on Delhi, the appeal process is completed. So that's next up on our list is Delhi. And I have a contract person starting in a couple of weeks to do a GIS map of all the mental health services in Guelph, all the housing services, the employment, where all the job vacancies are, and how do we bring all of that together into a community map so that we know where our priorities need to be going through the wintertime. Okay, over to you guys.
Okay, well, thank you for that detailed update. So I've got a bunch of questions. Can cities hope to address poverty and inadequate housing without a much more comprehensive federal housing program, you know, co-op, nonprofit, and social housing? Because the governments, both federal and provincial, kind of got out of the business of housing, I think, in the 90s.
Yep, it was the 90s. Yep. Yeah, the it is a very comprehensive program. We've got 6 streams, well, 8 streams, but there's 6 that are very active streams on CMHC, sorry, I always get that mixed up. The co-op piece, $1.5 billion has been announced for co-op housing. And so I've met with Peter Cameron, and then I also met with the Ontario Co-op Housing out of Kitchener to look at how do you get a co-op housing development done in Guelph, because we haven't done one for so long. And Fife Road, there's some opportunity there. I haven't spoken with their board, but they've got some space on their land to possibly expand the co-op that on Fife Road. We have 6 co-ops in Guelph. That's part of my map, including the housing co-op at the University of Guelph. So where would the co-op be located and who would be the board and how would you put that together is something that I'm working on in the background. And the Ontario Co-op out of Kitchener is, you know, they work with Guelph, and so they've got some potential sites and they would be the ones to help put together boards. I spoke with CMHC to say, here's a new funding stream to create co-op housing or to expand co-op housing or create new housing. I want to give you some priorities for Guelph. And so I floated a couple to them to say, if you get a call from somebody on Fife Road, we know about it. It's a, you know, it's one of the big potentials we have. So CMHC has a very direct relationship with me on the community priorities. And so co-op housing is hopefully, we will see some of the $1.5 billion from that's allocated for across Canada. We'll see some of that happening in Guelph. We also have seniors housing. And so part of the map is seniors housing. And my wife and I live in a seniors complex. And we are going to need more seniors housing as people get older. And so that's another piece that we have. I turned on my chat and I can see some chat questions, but do you want to select them or do you want me to go down or how do you
want to? Yeah, I do want to select them just to keep
okay,
us
go ahead.
Sort of, yeah,
sure.
On top. Yeah.
I'm in your hands, Tanya.
Pardon me?
I'm in your hands.
Okay. So with regards to housing, what services will be included in support of housing? So you mentioned co-op housing and some senior housing.
There's some potential for more supportive housing projects in Guelph. And if you look at Parkview and what happened there, it was already being used by Compass or by Stepping Stone. And they were working with CMHA, and they were working with the county. And so that was already, it was in place, but they didn't have the actual location for support of 24/7 at the motel. And so the renovation was to include 24/7 wraparound support. We have some other, we have the Rapid Housing Initiative phase three is now being announced. It's $2 billion. The projects have to be completed within a year of application. And so it's not for somebody to say, okay, I'm gonna build it out there sometime. You have to build within a year. So the motel conversion is one that can be done within a year. We have a couple of other sites in Guelph that could be done within a year. And I'm hopefully going to be meeting with the owners of those sites. I've talked to CMHA with Helen about, would you be in position to put some support into those places? And she said, absolutely. We're already doing it on call. To have it actually put in place physically is a more efficient way for them to provide care for people. And then we also working with the Community Health Center downtown Guelph with the addictions programs they have, with the safe injection and the rapid access program that they have, the Community Health Center would also be in a position to be able to support. So we just need the housing developments to be identified, go through City Council, and get the money in from the federal government. A good part of it from the federal government, a whole bunch of it still has to come from the city and the province, unfortunately, because that just adds a layer of complexity whenever the province is involved.
Okay, so you mentioned the CHC, and I'm gonna come to that after I ask this question. It is my understanding that the federal government is going to support not-for-profit long-term care facilities. Is that correct?
We don't have a distinguishing between for-profit or not-for-profit. They still have to provide their financials. But it goes through the province. So we've put long-term care funding to the province, and we've yet to see any of it flow. And so that's a lot of my frustration is, we put $1.8 billion to the province on mental health, and we haven't seen the investments in mental health. We need psychiatrists, and we don't have them. We need health workers. We don't have them. And in fact, budgets are being cut. And they've got $1.8 billion from the federal government. So we're putting money into long-term care because it is a creature of the province. It's something that the province has to manage. And we have agreements in place, but we haven't seen the money flowing yet. So that becomes really, really frustrating. But I do talk with seniors facilities in Guelph, including the long-term care facilities. And whether it's St. Joe's or the Elliott, they could all use support right now. St. Joe's has that huge development that we did through CMHC, $38 million from the federal government to create housing on site to have a campus of care. The campus of care includes long-term care. We haven't seen the investment coming in from the province, even though they've got the money from us.
Okay, so I do want to ask, it seems to be like a piecemeal approach to that. Would it be appropriate to reform the Canada Health Act to incorporate long-term care more extensively?
When it's care of individuals and delivery of services, you'd have to change the constitution on that. We also can't get involved with education. We can provide support. Reference frameworks. We can ask for this level of service to be delivered. How it actually gets done is really up to the provinces and territories, actually the provinces. In some cases in territories and in military bases, we can take over on Indigenous land, we can take over control, but we still need to work with the province on supplying people into those jobs. So the colleges that accredit medical workers or education workers, those colleges are all provincially managed through independent organizations, but they're provincially managed. So there's only so far we can go with the way that we're set up as a country.
Okay, fair enough. So with respect to how we're set up as a country, federal, provincial level, I guess some provinces are saying that the federal level doesn't provide enough money for healthcare in general. So maybe it's time for a sort of federal provincial summit with regards to the Canada Health Act. Now, what I just heard from you, what I understand is that that would actually not be possible to reform unless we mess with the Constitution, but perhaps a difference in the amount of money from the federal government.
Yeah. Funding formulas are something that we can change. And I mean, a lot of the noise leading up to this, and I'll call it noise, because that's how I see it. There is a review of the transfer payments coming up in the coming year. And so a lot of the media around we don't have enough money is them doing the public negotiating with the federal government, using the media to say that we don't have enough money. And that's okay, because we'll go into the negotiations and we'll look at the transfer payments have to be set up in a way that it's equitable so that all Canadians can have access to the same care, regardless of where you live in the country, including the North. The other part of it that's very disturbing for me is the way that the Health Act is set up is if you privately fund health or education, whatever you are funding privately gets taken off your transfer payment. And so if Ontario wants to go down the road, which it looks like they do, to have more privatized healthcare, then they're going to get less money from the federal government according to the way that we were set up. Because it's just like private daycare. Our money isn't to go into dividends to people that own healthcare facilities. It's to go into healthcare of Canadians. So if in this negotiations they're saying we're not getting enough money, okay, that's part of negotiating. We're not getting enough money. Then you go into the negotiations and then they're going to get some more money from the federal government. The more noise they make before that happens, then maybe they've got a better chance of getting more money from the federal government, who's also got the capacity to tax in a different way than the provincial government. So at some point, Canadians have to pay for whatever agreement we come up with. But if it's privatized care, and Alberta is a huge example of this, and Ontario is increasing, it's coming off your transfer, no doubt about it. So then they're going to come back and say, see, the federal government cut the funding, not saying it's because we're doing privatized care. So you'll see that play out over the next year.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, the back and forth. Okay, I wanted to sort of just quickly ask about drugs. Would the federal government consider decriminalizing drugs to decrease the amount of overdoses that are caused by dirty drugs? And then a second part of that question is, would the federal government also consider issuing pardons for simple possession?
Yeah, we have put in place pardons. We'll leave that one alone. We can go back to that one. We've got simple possession pardons that we've put in place a couple of years ago. The decriminalization project in British Columbia is one that we're watching really closely. And it's better to have a test market, and British Columbia is our test market. Before we go full blown on what does that mean, how do we implement it? In the meantime, what we've set up in May was an addictions court. Got to remember the name of it. I have to look it up. But if you look at Drug Court Canada, we're setting up a separate justice system for people that are addicted to drugs so that they're not going through the criminal justice system because they're not, I mean, it isn't a, mental health and addictions isn't something that you're going to solve by putting somebody in jail. And so what happens is people get arrested for drug-related criminal activity, and then they get released, and then they get arrested, and then they get released. And it's a cycle that we have in Guelph, that in order to work the system, you have to have an escalation of the charges, and then you can get into drug programs. We've got to change all that, because it's not good for the people that are going through the problems, definitely not good for police forces using, and it's not good for the plugging up the courts. So we have put in place the setting up of a drug court, so that people that are facing criminal charges because of drugs will go to a different treatment, different care program to try and get their addictions dealt with, so that they're not part of the criminal justice system. And so that is underway. I think it was in May this year we made the announcements. And so that's in process. So yes, decriminalization, something we're looking at BC. We think it is a solution, because we're not helping the people that have addictions, and we're feeding the illegal market, and the toxic drug supply is going to continue until we can get on top of this in a more effective way.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from you, I just want to make sure, is that you're looking at Vancouver as a pilot project.
British Columbia. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. You're looking at British Columbia sort of as a pilot with regards to decriminalization before you go Canada-wide. Yeah. And the second part is that you are working on, the federal government is working on a different court system for people who have addiction, mental health issues. Because now I want to make sure, because right now that sort of different court system takes effect when there are higher charges, let's say.
Well, it's a federal court system, and then you've got provincial court systems. So we're trying to set it up in a resilient way that will get treatment to people that we can only do what is in our control. And I was at a lunch sitting with the mayor, with the Home Builders Association, a couple of days ago, and he mentioned the stabbing in downtown Guelph to me, and I said, yeah, I know, the drug courts, national drug courts, you can Google that. The drug courts are what we're putting in place from our side federally. Provincially, I mean, hopefully they also pick up on this, because the legal system needs a better solution. So the people that manage legal systems will hopefully put the pressure in the right places.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. I want to go towards inflation again, and with regards to heating costs, because we're approaching winter. Germany is going to help out its citizens pay for heat, a substantial amount. And would that be something that the federal government would consider, because it would help Canadians that are hit hard by inflation?
I'm sorry, my mind went into Germany. I've got to come back to Canada. Okay. Yeah, we're trying to make a deal with Germany right now. They don't like the price that we've offered. We're not going to give them the deal that the Americans have. We hope to supply natural gas to Germany because of what Putin has been doing. And we've created a dialogue on that. And those negotiations are very hot right now, because winter is coming and Putin is still doing what he's doing. So back to Canada, when we're working on heating in Canada, it's a balance between climate change and the economic impacts, and making sure that people that are heating houses can continue to heat their houses, and particularly in rural and northern areas where they don't have alternates to oil or natural gas. And so we are putting different supports in place for things like heating homes in northern and remote communities. But we've also put in place incentives for people to put cleaner solutions in place. And so you can get incentives for greening your house. And part of that includes getting more efficient heating systems put in place. But we're not going to back down on the climate change piece, where Germany is, and I'll give you more of my own personal opinions on this, is Germany walked away from nuclear. We haven't done that. And it's a good thing we didn't. We are working on nuclear storage, and I've gone up to the Chippewas of the Nawash this summer. I've talked to the Saugeen chief. I spent time on reserve this summer looking at the deep hole repository for nuclear waste. We did a study in the Environment Committee around storage of nuclear waste. We've been creating waste for 60 years. We have to do something better with it than what we have been doing. So we're working on solutions by the end of 2023. On the deep hole repository and making sure we're engaging with Indigenous communities properly. And that was really a big part of what I was doing up there this summer. And also looking at the water project that Nawash has. It's the largest water project actually in North America right now, where we're changing all their water lines, their new water treatment plant. I used to do that work before politics, before chambers of commerce. I did a lot of work on installations of mechanical systems and I did a lot of work on Indigenous communities as well. So the chief is really happy that they're going to have clean drinking water by the end of 2023. And she said to me, if it's clean water and you can come up for a cold glass of clean water. And I said, well, the chief at Saugeen offered me some tea. So I'm going to have tea with him. Then I'll come and have a glass of water with you. But she said 2023, the end of it, if they get to that point of all new new water lines and water treatment plants, she's fine with that. And the consultations on the deep hole repository are going better than they started, and they are being listened to. So we think we're on the right path there. If it isn't there, it's going to be Red Lake, possibly, if the community there can accept it. So nuclear is a part of the solution. I want to put that on the table that Germany doesn't have. And then we have other ways of supporting Canadians while at the same time fighting climate change.
Yes, because that is the fine balance, right? Climate change and heating and helping people who can't afford heat, right?
Because the climate, the climate doesn't really care that you can't afford. You're putting stuff in the air. The stuff in the air is what's going to cause climate change. And if you keep putting stuff in the air, I'm going to keep doing what I do, is what Mother Nature is saying.
I hope that renewables will be able to be scaled up soon.
There is the Net Zero Accelerator Fund, and we have put that in place, and I have been directing people in Guelph towards that. There's some solutions coming out of Guelph on the Net Zero Accelerator Fund, and there's billions of dollars in that as well. And that is the next economy. In the Environment Committee, we're just finishing a study on clean technologies. We see that shift in the market of providing clean technology solutions for climate change gives us a massive economic opportunity at the same time as fighting climate change. So how do we do more of that? And how do we make sure that people are connecting in? So we have the Net Zero Hub in Ottawa. The Net Zero Hub handles the innovation centers across Canada, including Innovation Guelph. And later on today, I'm with Innovation Guelph at the Innovation Expo. I'm really interested to see what we're doing on clean technology, because it's a global opportunity. And if Canada can lead on that, we're going to benefit from climate change progress as well as the economic benefits that you get from providing clean technology solutions.
Absolutely. And I heard recently that green energy is becoming one of the top sectors and is employing more and more people.
Yeah, biomass is huge. And you look at the University of Guelph, and locally we've got Cargill providing biomass opportunities. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I wanted to jump back to carbon pricing and the GST rebate. These measures do not help people who are living effectively off the grid. Perhaps they don't pay income taxes.
Yeah, the only connection we can have, even if you have a zero tax return, is to do a tax return. And you don't have to apply for your credits. They're going to come to you. So if you're off the grid, it's just a check from the federal government with no expense against it. And that's the intention of carbon pricing, is you're going to get this money regardless. And now we're going to do it quarterly because the checks are going to be bigger and the costs are also bigger at the same time. So the $185 coming to people this Friday is a double payment. You should be getting about $100 a quarter from the federal government to pay for the cost of carbon that you're purchasing. If you're not purchasing any carbon, you've got $100 from the federal government to go towards whatever you want. So you don't have to apply for it, but it has to come through CRA. It's the only relationship we have with people where we can transfer money to them directly without going through provinces or other ways. It's what we used for the CERB payments and the CEWS payments. All of the emergency payments we did through the pandemic were done through a CRA relationship. Even rent support for businesses, we had to do through CRA because that's really our lifeline to the Canadians' bank accounts is CRA. So people have to do returns, even if it's a zero return. You've got to do a return so that you have that relationship set up.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to shift again. There was a question in the chat. Finding employment as an older adult, especially 55 plus, outside of restaurant and hospitality is especially difficult. And there are more older workers that need to continue working even beyond the regular retirement age. So how can the federal government support having employers to want to hire an older worker?
Well, right now the demand is high. So, I mean, employers should be hiring anybody that can fit a position that, and if they're not hiring, frankly, it's their fault. It's the employer's fault. If they have a job vacancy right now and they've got people knocking on the door looking for work, we've provided accommodations for training. They can get federal support for tools. They can get support for taking courses. All of the upgrading has been put in place from the federal government. The employers really shouldn't have an excuse to not be hiring people right now. They also have to pay higher wages. And so that's another thing. You might not be able to hire a person for the wages that you're used to paying because the market is what it is right now. There's a shortage. You're going to have to pay better. Then the other side of it is they still have to be profitable. And those are things that we need to discuss. What we're looking at, not looking at, it's a discussion that's going on, is how do we incent retired people to come back and work? And it's a very simplistic argument, I think. I don't think it's taking into account what actual 66-year-olds, I can talk from personal experience. I'm not sure I'd want to be doing what I was doing before, where I have to be sharp at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And if I'm designing machines, I'm not as sharp as I was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I can get up early and I can do work in the morning. So the other part of it is flexible hours. How do we incent retired people to come back to work is really a challenge that we're discussing as one of the options. Women in the workforce is a huge part for us, is that women are underrepresented. They need to be paid equitably. They need to have the opportunities provided to them. And so we have women's entrepreneurship programs. We have women training programs. We have the child care program to help people that are looking after children get back into the workforce. We think women are going to be a huge opportunity for us to fill the vacancies. Indigenous people is another stream that we're looking at. And then older people is another stream. But the employers have to do their job.
Yes, with regards to supply and demand, they have to pay a proper wage to the workers.
That's it. I mean, there's a shortage of supply. So they know from business, I know from business, if there's a shortage of supply, you pay more. There's no way around that.
Exactly. And speaking of workers, what is the federal government doing to ensure that all migrant workers in Canada get permanent residency status?
Yeah, we have some accelerated programs that we've just introduced for students, and we're working on with Ukraine. we put them on an accelerated path to permanent residency if they choose to. So we've got some examples in Atlantic Canada where we've also done some acceleration. In Northern Ontario, we've done some acceleration. So we've done some market testing over the last few years on doing that. If you're a student studying in Canada, we want you working in Canada. And there is a labor shortage around the world, but we're ahead of the game. Once you're in Canada, we need to close the door and not allowed to lock it, but we got to make it really, really attractive for people to stay in Canada. And so we're trying to put those programs in place. And I do see a note about the $15.50 an hour not being a living wage. And yes, and that, when it comes to labor in the workforce, the labor rates, that's all provincial. And so we can set rates in Canada. The Canadian government has set living wage standards for federally employed people. We've increased the minimum wage for federally employed people, and not a lot of federally employed people are frankly on the minimum wage, but we can only do what's within our control. We can't force the provinces to, I mean, the provinces were heading that way under the Wynne government, and then Ford killed the pilot program that the Liberal government had in Ontario, as an example. And I just have to sit and watch it, you know, and it's frustrating as hell for me.
Yes, and there's always the age-old argument about raising minimum wage. I was listening to the CBC recently, and some people say that if you raise the minimum wage, that workers will get fewer hours and fewer workers will be employed. Yeah. And other people say that it would help somewhat. And other people say that some restaurants will close down, for example. So there's lots of arguments.
There's lots of arguments.
That's what I'm saying.
In the market that we're in right now, and we're going to be in this for a while, it's an unusual market where it's supply constrained. Usually we're not supply constrained. So housing supply is constrained right now. We're working on supply programs with the city of Guelph as well on their permitting process to help them go electronic on permitting. There was a two-step that the city of Guelph had to do in order to, they didn't have software to upgrade, and we had programs to upgrade software. Well, they didn't have the software. So we're working on some of those details with the city of Guelph right now to help them get the software they need, and then to help with the permitting to try and get more supply into the market. And we have all kinds of money in that program to try and help municipalities. And I'm working with the Western Wardens Caucus to try and help the smaller communities access digital support as well. So the supply of housing, the supply of labor, all of those supply things that we're doing, supply of materials, we're in a really weird situation. And I've been in business for 40 years now. I started my first business when I was 29, and it was in manufacturing. And I've gone through a lot of recessions, and I know at the end of a recession, it's hard to get stuff, but you can get it, but now you can't get it. There's a supply problem across the world that we're dealing with.
Okay.
So then that brings up a topic of Canadian supply, and that's another area. So we kind of joke to ourselves, and it's not much of a joke, I guess, but we say, well, it's not like we're trying to run a country, but yeah, it actually takes a fair amount of government intervention and management. Regardless of what the conservatives might say, letting the market go is not the solution, because the inequities will continue. We need to help to manage the economy in a way that is still a free market, but in a way that everybody can participate. So how do you get the lower income people up a notch in the ladder? And how do you take the taxes on the higher income and increase the taxes so that gets brought into the government instead of taking taxes from people that can't afford to pay taxes? So all that stuff is in play. And tax is something we've been working with the NDP on. The NDP has been screaming at us around corporate taxes. We have been changing corporate taxes, not fast enough for them. But we also have to attract money from outside of Canada. So there's definitely a balance that has to happen. If we increase corporate taxes too much, the businesses are going to move to another country, because most of the businesses in Canada are foreign owned. So it's not an easy balance, but it's something that we're trying to do in a way that keeps equity going. And then the conservatives just want to get rid of it all. So,
okay. Do you have time for one more question?
Yep.
Okay. I'll try to make it quick. It's with regards to refugees. It appears that the status of Ukrainians is very different than, say, the status of other refugees, for example, Afghan refugees. Some people believe that the Afghan refugees are being sort of pushed aside in favor of Ukrainians. Can you comment on this, please?
Yeah, I've heard those arguments. I did put a flyer out to the community to say we're working on both. It's not an either or. Two different situations for sure. Ukraine refugees are coming across a border with nothing. They're not, the first ones came across the border in cars. Now they're walking across the border. They have no papers. They have nothing. They're coming out of a war zone. And so they're getting treated differently. And we've set up triage units at the border. And we are literally grabbing people, telling people as they come across the border, go to that booth over there and we'll start the processing. I know you don't have your passport. You don't have any documents. We have to deal with that differently. And we have different ways of dealing with that. And it's usually mothers and children. And it's very identifiable groups that are coming across the border. Afghan is a different situation, and we are dealing with partner countries to get Afghan refugees here through the channels that we have been normally using, which is refugee camps. But we have got, I think 26,000 was the number I saw on Monday when I was going through my briefing notes. We're trying to get it up to 40,000 from Afghanistan, and we do have supports in Guelph to help with both Ukraine and Afghanistan, and we're trying to make it possible for both. And now we've got Iran will be another one that we need to deal with, and then Somalia continues on, and Eritrea, we've got refugees in Eritrea. What it boils down to, Canada is a safe country, and there's fewer safe countries in the world now, and I would even extend that to the United States. That Canada is a place where people know if they can get here, it's going to be a little bit difficult because you're isolated and it's colder and you're not close to family. But people are choosing to come to Canada and we're trying to help them with that. So our general immigration, we've increased now to over 400,000, going towards 450,000. We think that 10% of our population is a number where we need to start paying attention. Because of housing and primarily, and then education and healthcare will also be impacted by the more people we allow into Canada. Do we have the supports for them when they get here? So we are increasing our overall immigration. We're one of the only countries in the world that is stimulating its immigration policies because we also see the economic opportunity. We have jobs to fill. And we need young people. We don't have young people in Canada. Our population's getting older. The only growing young population we have in Canada is our Indigenous population. And so then back to Indigenous rights and making sure Indigenous people, if they choose to participate in the economy, we have the opportunities for them. And it's their choice and it has to be their choice. So, no, we're not saying we don't want Afghanistan. We're transferring everything over to the Ukraine. It's not the case at all. It's two different systems and two different challenges that we have.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to answer our questions and to give us an update on what's going on in the federal government.
Well, thanks for having me and meeting with you guys always kickstarts my brain for the day. So instead of 2 o'clock, I might need a nap at 12 o'clock. Not that I take a nap at 2 o'clock. I'm your member of parliament. I don't take naps. So, thanks for stimulating the gray cells this morning. And thanks for having these breakfasts. I mean, seriously, these are great community events, and it's great to have the community getting together to talk about meaningful things like all of the things that we're working on together.
Okay. Thank you. And
great to have.
Have a great week.
thanks, guys. And we'll see you at the restaurant at some point, I hope.
Yeah, we hope so too. looking at the numbers,
nobody's talking about that right now. And I don't know why people aren't talking about the numbers, but go on WDG website and look at the numbers from the sewage water treatment or whatever they call it. yeah, we're not in a good place. So take care of yourself. Stay well.
Okay, you too.
Okay, thanks, guys.
So if you want to see some more information or hear more information about the candidates that are running in your ward and the mayoral candidates, you've got a cornucopia of sources. Guelph Chamber of Commerce has a YouTube channel. Guelph Today has interviews with candidates. Guelph Mercury Tribune also does. Guelph Politico has interviews with candidates, and it also just posted the mayoral forum, and you can watch that or you can read a summary. And on the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour, you can find the recordings of the ward forums for each ward that occurred on October the 6th. The Downtown Renewal Project is going to be undergoing some environmental assessments. So on November the 2nd, between 6:30 and 8:30 p.m. at City Hall or via Zoom, you can learn about these assessments, you can ask questions, and you can provide feedback for things like cars and bike lanes, and if you have any suggestions about how the studies can be improved. There is a Truth and In Journalism conference. It is put on by the Walrus, and it is running from Wednesday, October 19th to Friday, October the 21st. It is free and it is online. So please go to thewalrus.ca/truthinjournalism for more information. Now, next week, there will be no show on the Breezy Breakfast. We hope that you will be focusing on getting to know your candidates if you haven't already voted. And remember to vote on the 24th of October. Coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, on October the 27th, there will be a post-election post-mortem. And then after that, in November, some of the ideas that we have are the role of nuclear power in getting to net zero, rainwater capture. We're thinking of having water watchers on as a guest to discuss Guelph's ability to provide water for 208,000 people by 2051. And we'd like to talk about inclusive zoning and what that would mean for affordable housing. So that is all for today. And I hope you have a great week and a great next week. Please get out and vote. There's advanced voting this weekend. And we'll see you on October the 27th.
Now we are here, Marva Wisdom moderating a brief forum with Adrian Salvatore, Brandon Clark, and Linda Bustel, three candidates running for election in Ward 4.
Well, the first question that we have, the first theme is about well-being. And we're excited for these Ward 4 candidates who are a part of this conversation. We're calling it a forum. It is not a debate. And our three candidates that we have are Adrian Salvatore, and we have Linda Busatil, and we have Brendan Clark. And so we're excited that they're able to be here, and regrets were sent by Hitesh Jagad that he could not be here because of a family emergency. And so the first question is about well-being. The vision statement of Guelph Strategic Plan is an inclusive, connected, prosperous city where we look after each other and our environment. And the first adjective is inclusive. And while most Guelphites value diversity, some citizens still suffer from hate and other forms of abuse, such as racist and anti-2SLGBTQ+ incidents. The question is, how will you help Guelph progress toward its inclusivity vision? And maybe I'll ask Adrian to start. We drew lots, and so I think Adrian was first, and then followed by Linda, and then followed by Brendan. Adrian, please.
Great. Thank you very much, Marva. And of course, thank you for everybody for organizing this event, and thank you for all of our attendees for joining us today. Hate has no home in our community. There's no room for it here in Guelph. We need to underpin our inclusivity on communication. and making sure we are contacting all of our stakeholders, making sure our neighbors are up to date. Now, I've heard from many residents here in Ward 4 that they haven't been kept up to date very well with what's going on in our community and don't feel like the lines of communication between the city and our residents is very strong. I aim to change that. It is essential that we are taking into account people's lived experiences and people's voices and promoting and championing them so that we can build a city that works for everybody. Thank you.
And over to Linda. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you. From my experience, again, from the school board and even the Ontario Public School Board Association, looking at equity and inclusion in our systems. For me, inclusivity starts with, and my role would be to ensure that it's not what I call a caboose, something that is an afterthought that you think about, that it is a policy and procedure, and it's the lens through which you do everything, and constantly asking the question, whose voice is? What was the way that community members were engaged? Was it just, you know, online surveys and so on, asking those questions and really grounding it? The other piece is to ensure that I bring my experience with residents in Ward 4 and create those spaces, those safe and inclusive spaces where city staff and problem statements or problem identification, those conversations can take place at the grassroots in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Brendan?
So I'll answer it the exact same way that I did the first time. So our city council currently is a very cohesive looking group. I believe I've heard that there's never been a member of a minority group on council, and I want to learn why that is. Ultimately, as a middle-aged or young white male, I don't have the lived experiences that many minority group members do. I understand that I don't know everything. I don't know much compared to people that have lived these experiences. And as with everything in my campaign, everything comes back to proactive engagement. I want to learn from these members, understand where their problems are, and ultimately help them achieve their goals if they're looking to get into the political realm, whether as a counselor or just a member of the community that wants to participate in these discussions. So my promise is to advocate and to listen to these members and help them become part of the conversation.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to climate change and how we might get Guelph to reach net zero by 2050. And we're gonna go backwards. We're gonna start with Linda and then Brendan and then Adrian.
Thank you. So I am very familiar with the City Council's motion, the resolution that was passed in December 2021. And what I was concerned about, and I immediately contacted the mayor as the chair of the Upper Grand District School Board, is that even though we were named as community partners and school boards, there was no engagement with us as a partner in an organization and institution. And my belief is that in order to achieve these goals, school boards, the university, the college, all partners need to be involved in the process, in having the conversation, in scaffolding our resources and putting together measurements and holding each other accountable. And that was lacking. And so there was a commitment from the mayor at the time, Mayor Guthrie, that we would move forward with that kind of a conversation. That is something that I want to see continued, and I would advocate from City Council as a city councilor on those climate change goals.
Great. Brendan?
I want to acknowledge that I appreciate the move that Guelph has made to become net zero by the year 2050, but that's not that far away. Ultimately, I want to view this as through the lens of affordability and looking to find green technologies that are more efficient and more affordable than what we're currently using. What it comes down to for me is ultimately we all want a net zero Guelph. But if it's a net zero Guelph that our residents can't afford to live in, then what's the point? So let's look for technologies and new ways to do things that are efficient, more economical, and ultimately will create an affordable Guelph that's also net zero. Thank you.
Thanks, Brendan. Adrian?
Thank you for the question, Marva. I am very supportive of moving our city towards its corporate net zero goal, as well as working towards our community becoming net zero. I do think it's important to take a holistic approach when we talk about emissions in our community and not place too much focus on the corporate emission side, because conceivably we could have situations where if the city, say, ran more buses, we could have an increase in corporate emissions, but a decrease in total community emissions if people are opting for transit instead. So I think it takes a whole community approach and a lot of cooperation with our different community organizations and members. The city has a place to be a leader in promoting sustainable building practices on its corporate buildings and its infrastructure, and supporting our partners developing the community to do the same. Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian. In the interest of ensuring that we're not holding up our audience, because we promised you either nor you with children and other responsibilities at home, I am going to ask each of you to take just 1 minute to do your elevator pitch and your wrap up for the purposes of recording for your Ward 4 residents who want to hear from you and why they should vote for you. So I will go and start with Brendan first, and then I will go to Adrian and then Linda.
Thanks. So when I entered this race, I entered as a concerned resident and a concerned father. I had a 3 week old at the time and was really debating whether or not I had the time to do this. But the more I talked to my family and talked to my neighbors, I learned that when people said we're becoming less affordable, what it really boiled down to was a value for taxes. We know taxes aren't going away, but as residents that live on the outskirts of the city, the constituents in Ward 4 felt that their taxes were being used less in Ward 4. For me, it boils down to creating a Guelph, and specifically a Ward 4, where we can all live inclusively and affordably. I want somewhere where myself, my family, my neighbors, and most importantly, my children are excited to live in and excited to grow up in and ultimately want to live in the future. I understand that by asking for the voice of the residents of Ward 4, I'm asking for a huge commitment on your part, and know that in return for me, you will get someone that will run through walls to make this community as best as it possibly can. I've reached out to approximately 300 or 400 of you now, and I'm looking forward to meeting more of you at the doors and hearing more of your concerns. I really, 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 really want to express the need for people to get out and vote in this election. Do your research, learn about your candidates, and get out and vote on the 24th. Thank you for this time, and thank you for listening and for getting out and voting on the 24th. Oh my God.
Thank you, Brendan. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you very much, Marva. So my name is Adrian Salvatore, and I'm running to be your next city councilor for here in Ward 4. I originally came to Guelph in 2015 to study at the University of Guelph, where I completed a Bachelor of Computing and a Certificate in Business. I live here in Ward 4 in the Parkwood Gardens neighborhood. The reason I'm running for councillor is because I believe there's a lot of opportunity here in our community. I love Guelph. It's a great place, and I decided to make it my home. And I want to make Guelph the best community for everybody here. The issues I'm addressing in my campaign are affordability, transit, mental health and drug addiction, homelessness, and modernizing our city services. I think affordability is at the forefront of everybody's mind, and we need action on housing affordability now. The municipality has a lot of tools at its disposal that we can use to make housing more affordable for our residents, promote supportive housing working with our county, and promote mental health and drug addiction programs working with our county and provincial partners. I aim to do those to make Guelph the best it can be for all our residents here. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Linda.
Thank you, Marva. So my name is Linda Buzatil, and I'm running for Ward 4 City Councilor. I've had the honor of being elected a school board trustee in the City of Guelph for 4 terms. And with that comes a lot of experience with property and building committees, budgets, policies, legislation, and building relationships with Wellington and Dufferin counties and all levels of government. I am very active in my community, in the city, and especially in Ward 4, where I make connections and work to make a hands-on difference for families. Some specific initiatives I've worked on are the establishment of the Guelph Youth Music Center, downtown Guelph, years of work on the International Baccalaureate Program, located to support the city's downtown secondary plan at GCVI. And in Ward 4, I actively volunteer hands-on organizing events like the annual fall fair and tackle food insecurity by creating community gardens at Castlebury Park and on Westwood Road, collective kitchen and food skills programs for youth and adults. I am running because I am not discovering issues of affordability, housing, food, transportation, and income. I have been actively working at the grassroots on these issues, and I'm asking for your vote to support my campaign and elevate my efforts to access information, plans, budgets, and be able to put my brain to organizing and connecting to better the circumstances for families in Ward 4. My vision for Guelph is a city where everyone feels at home, a place where we have strong connections with neighbors, where we care about each other, the environment, and we learn about and celebrate our rich diversity. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you, Linda. I just want to say again very quickly how honored, I think all of us, Karen, Christelle was helping with timing, how honored we are to have the three of you and to hear from you tonight. Thank you for your flexibility from the challenges that we faced with our technical glitch at the beginning that created where the recording did not happen, and that you were great sports and recorded what I'm hoping that doing it a second time, that you felt that it was that it was rich and that it conveyed what you wanted to convey to Ward 4. As a resident of Ward 4, I received what you said, not only as a moderator, but certainly as a resident that has been living here for 35 years. So thank you for the honor of working with you and getting your voice outside and getting your voice heard. We will check to see whether we can have you perhaps for the other questions, if you wanted to maybe send in your response, if you choose to, if we sent the questions to you again, I will check. Karen, of course, part of the organizing committee, will check in on that, the feasibility, and check with you if you're comfortable doing that. It's going to be up to you, certainly. And my voice is here if anybody just wants to do another, an additional recording, if your time allows, that you want to put up on the site. I'll make that open to you as well. And open to the organizers. So thank you so much. Good luck on your campaign. Please visit City of Guelph website, those who are listening, so that you can support these wonderful candidates who are working to make our city better. So all the best to everyone. Karen is going to put up a screen with the organizations that has helped us. If that's available, Karen, this is a good time to throw it up there as we say goodbye to the audience. And certainly goodbye to our candidates. And we will see you as you run around Ward 4 and getting ready to be elected. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you, Marva. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Christelle, as well.
That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in to Breezy Breakfast, where the coffee is hot and the discussion is even hotter.